Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
We're sitting here in the Michener Museum in Doylestown in the midst of the exhibit Show Business Irving Berlin's Hollywood with curator, is it, and archivist, David Leopold, who has written a wonderful book, actually a beautiful book as well, a coffee table book, we used to call it, but it is really exquisite. David, bravo.
Thank you very much. Well, you know, they don't call them coffee table books anymore.
See, I'm dated.
Well, in the publishing industry, they get all worked up if you say coffee table books. They call them large format pictorial nonfiction.
So we actually have gotten a copy of this coffee table book. It is beautiful, though. I must say the reproductions of the posters and, of course, the very interesting commentary. It's really quite a special thing to have. How much does it weigh?
It weighs over 3 pounds. I encourage people to get 2 copies, one for upstairs and downstairs, because I don't want anyone to get hurt carrying it around.
It is very heavy because it is done on this beautiful paper, this coated paper, and as I say, the full color and actually very fine detail is
published by Harry Abrams, the most prestigious art book publisher in America. It's called Irving Berlin Show Business, and it not only covers his Hollywood work, of course, but also his work on Broadway and what I term his American work.
Really, so it's 3 sections, really.
3 sections. The chapters are interleaved between Broadway, Hollywood, and America. And those stories of the Broadway musical or the film musical or American popular song is Berlin's story.
Now, David, just to digress a little bit, you say that you do exhibits around the country. You do traveling exhibits?
Yes.
That you actually speak about?
I organize and oversee the production of. I work as a curator for museums just about, not only in this country, but in Europe as well, on a wide variety of topics. I have a deep abiding love for the performing arts, and whenever I can find an intersection between the performing arts and the visual arts, well, I'm there.
Now, how did you start with this? Were you always interested in art and in film and in, you know, theater?
Sure. I think that those are sort of the touchstones in life. The arts, I don't know what people do who don't know great music and great film and great books. They prepare you for everything and give you a sense of, you know, when the going gets tough, they're there to fall back on. I've been very, very fortunate. I never set out to do this. It sort of found me. It was dark and they were big.
Uh-huh.
And I curated some exhibitions in college just as a favor for people on the history of the student theater and things like that. And one thing led to another, and people kept on asking me, and I kept on doing them. And it's been almost 20 years now that I've been putting together exhibitions.
And he only looks like he's 18, by the way. Now, you just came off of an exhibition in New York. Was it at Lincoln Center?
Yes, I've done 2 shows in connection with this book. The show in New York, which I organized for the New York Public Library of the Performing Arts, was on his Broadway career. He got his start on Broadway in 1909, and it essentially is still going on. They've just made a stage adaptation of White Christmas this spring.
Really?
They'll see a stage adaptation of Easter Parade. And unlike so many of the other sort of jukebox musicals, the production of White Christmas is actually quite good. As a real story, it's a very good show. As opposed to of course there's great songs in it, but it's a very good show. It's adapted from the film of the same name.
Well, you know, I noticed in Broadway they are going back. They're doing revivals, and I think they're looking for old material to redo on Broadway. It's very, I don't know what that means, if it's a commentary on what's going on in theater, but those things stand up so very, very well. I mean, a little bit of rewriting on the book and... and they work.
Well, as a matter of fact, this season coming up, the Encore series, which is a great series in New York, which revived Chicago, for instance, and wonderful town, is devoting a whole season to reviews in honor of the 100th anniversary of the Ziegfeld Follies.
Oh, yes.
And one of the shows that they're going to do is Face the Music, Irving Berlin's Face the Music, which he wrote in 1932 with Moss Hart, which was a sort of parody of reviews among the many subjects that it was a parody of. Of course, Berlin wrote the theme song for the Ziegfeld Follies, A Pretty Girl is Like a Melody. He also created his own reviews called the Music Box Reviews in for a theater that he built, and that still stands, called the Music Box Theater.
The Music Box in Manhattan, sure.
And then he revolutionized the review in 1933 with As Thousands Cheer, which starred Clifton Webb, Marilyn Miller, Helen Broderick, and a young black singer by the name of Ethel Waters, Philadelphian.
Yes, and I think that was it was a review, exactly.
It was a review based on a newspaper. And so the weather report was heat wave. The funnies were the funnies. But they wanted to do a song about the rotogravure section of the newspaper. And so Berlin wrote Easter Parade.
Yes, I think that As Thousands Cheer was a big movie, and I believe it was in the 40s, was it?
Well, there was a film called Thousands Cheer, which was not the same as the review.
As Thousands Cheer.
No, the review was really quite remarkable because Ethel Waters performed in it, and she had just introduced Stormy Weather at the Cotton Club. Berlin came up to see her and said, I'd like to inject a serious note into the show, and asked her to come down and rehearse with him. She sang a song called Supper Time. Now, each one of the skits and songs of the show was introduced by a newspaper headline that was projected above the stage. And when she came on to sing Supper Time, the headline was Unknown Negro Lynched by a Frenzied Mob. And she comes on very simply dressed, kerchief on her head, bare wall in the background, and she sings Supper Time. I should set the table, it's supper time, but I ain't able because that man of mine ain't coming home no more.
And so it was a commentary already.
It was a commentary. I mean, it's a great lover's lament, of course.
Yes.
But when you put it in context with that,
absolutely.
I mean, it's really mind-blowing. And this is 1933.
Yes.
It's not is way before civil rights is fashionable.
You start with his career, which, how old was he when he wrote that very first musical?
Well, the first song is in 1907, and he was all of 19 years old. He would live to be 101. His active career, though, ends in 1966. And when I say active career, where he's really publishing new songs and writing new songs for shows and for just individual songs for people to sing, he would continue to write some songs. But, you know, by 1966, he's 78 years old. He's been working for a very, very long time, over six decades, and has had the greatest successes that anybody could have in the songwriting business.
Yes, he actually was. He knew Gershwin, I believe, didn't he?
Gershwin auditioned for him as a musical secretary, and Berlin did not write his own music. I mean,
yes,
write down his own music.
He couldn't. I know he couldn't transpose music.
He only could play an F sharp, and he had a special piano.
What a ridiculous key!
It is true,
it's
and it just goes to show you the genius of Irving Berlin that he could write all these great songs. He had a composing piano, which was popular in Tin Pan Alley, where he could turn a lever and change the key that he was playing in.
You have a picture of that in the book. Don't
of course,
you?
I mean, he had those were his. He called my Buick because the original one had it wasn't a lever so much as it was a wheel that you turned. He had three pianos. One he often kept in New York. One he kept in Hollywood, and one that traveled around with him wherever he went.
I often wonder about these wonderful tunesmiths and composers who really had no background. They really, of course, wasn't his father a cantor?
His father was a cantor.
Yes.
He died when Berlin was 8 years old. And 5 years later, Berlin was out on the street living. He had decided he couldn't support his end of the family. It was one too many mouths to feed, so he decided to strike out on his own.
So David Leopold, we've just seen this wonderful compilation of film clips that you have put together. It's really amazing, and the film quality is amazing as well in the early films.
Thank you. It's very easy when you have great material to work with. When you're talking about the jazz singer, or Young Frankenstein, or Easter Parade, or Top Hat, these are some of the great films of movie-making history, and they all share one thing in common. They all had Irving Berlin songs. Over 100 films have had Irving Berlin songs from 1927 until the present, the most recent being Prairie Home Companion, which has Meryl Streep and Garrison Keillor singing All Alone.
That's right, All Alone. Well, Irving Berlin was pretty much all alone, wasn't he? His father died when he was very, very young, and of course he lived with his mother.
He lived with his mother till he was 13, and then decided that he wasn't bringing enough money in to feed himself, so he didn't want to be a burden on his family, so he went out and lived on the street. The Bowery at that time had 10,000 homeless people, luckily for him, the unofficial mayor of Chinatown, a fellow by the name of Chuck Connors, liked him and got him a job as a singing waiter in a real Bowery dive called the Pelham Cafe, which Alexander Wolcott would later say was a round table for pickpockets and thieves. And there he gained notoriety for writing parody lyrics to popular songs. And one day his boss demanded that he write a song with the piano player because a saloon up the street, the piano player had written a hit song and everybody was going there. So Berlin and a fellow by the name of Nicholson wrote a song called Marie from Sunny Italy, which was published in 1907. If you don't know it, it's because it was not a very good song. Berlin claimed he made 37 cents on the song.
Oh, my.
In my book, I show a royalty statement that he made $1.20, so we explode that myth.
Okay. Well, the point was that he was part of that whole ethnic mix in the Lower East Side, that everyone was scratching, and I don't think there were any child labor laws in those days. And
No, this is really the beginning
the Wild
of what
West,
we know
yeah.
of modern times.
Yeah, right. And he also was a song plugger, I think, didn't he play?
Yes, well, one of his first jobs was a song plugger at Tony Pastor's Vaudeville House, where he would sit up in the balcony and, for Harry Von Tilzer, would spontaneously break out into song that was being performed on stage and get people to sing along with him. He was a street busker before he became a singing waiter. He never lost the ability to really sell a song. And even when he was a great songwriter, when he was premiering songs for the first time, he gave it his all, just like he was a kid on the street for his first time. We have a wonderful letter in the exhibition that Fred Astaire wrote to the director Mark Sandrich that describes Berlin sort of selling the songs to a 1938 film called Carefree to Fred Astaire. And Fred Astaire says he was so excited he forgot to breathe. He fell off his piano stool twice. You know, he was so intent on making it a success.
Well, he was compelling, probably. Of course, the lyrics he wrote, the music and the lyrics, which is also another incredible thing. And he was a little man and not a very attractive one. This story about his wife was very moving in the book. You talk about the song that he wrote. What is it, When I Lost You?
When I Lost You. In 1912, he married the sister of a sometimes collaborator. Her name was Dorothy Goetz. They honeymooned in Cuba, and there she caught typhoid and died 5 months later. Berlin was distraught. He didn't know what to do. His brother-in-law said, put it into song, and Berlin said, look, I write happy Johnny tunes. How am I going to put this into a song? And I don't feel that, you know, this is my personal life. How am I going to put it into a song? Well, his brother-in-law insisted, and he remembered a melody that he had written, and he wrote this song, which at that time was second only to Alexander's Ragtime Band in popularity, which was the big hit. And the Berlin Ballad would, of course, become one of the great things. Cole Porter sings about it in You're the Top. It's right up there with the Waldorf Salad.
Oh, yes. Always is a very moving one, too. That's much later on. But this was 1911, Alexander's Ragtime Band, wasn't
yes.
it? And that was really
that was a monster
hit.
That
yes.
was that was a hit not only all over the country but all over the world. And Berlin was really considered the voice of American music, which was pretty incredible for a fellow who couldn't really play music, couldn't write or read music.
Absolutely incredible.
And he was called the King of Ragtime, although he wrote songs about ragtime, but no songs of ragtime. He had great success on Broadway, and in 1927, Ziegfeld, who had bought the rights to an Edna Ferber book, gave it to Berlin and thought that he might write the score. And Berlin read it and said, "I don't think it has any commercial prospects."
Was it Showboat by any chance?
It was Showboat. And but Berlin already had his eye towards something else.
Well, we're oohing and aahing over posters that are from the very, very early period of Irving Berlin's fame. Where are we starting from now?
The exhibition is broken up into several different sections. This section is from that covers the period from 1927 to 1931. Berlin wrote a couple of really wonderful songs in this period, but on a whole, the period was a disaster for him. It shook him so much that at the end of it, he thought he might be all washed up as a songwriter.
Why? Because he didn't have successes, big successes?
Well, they didn't know how to make movie musicals at this
right.
time. They were all these sort of tired backstage stories the songs really didn't have anything to do with the story. There were a lot of mediocre songs along with a couple of great songs. The performances were not particularly well done. And Berlin got a couple of great ones. Putting on the Ritz comes from this period. And I'm Happy.
Tell us about Marie. That was rather intriguing.
Well, one of the first things he did when he came to Hollywood, you know, he was already a legend in his own time. Jerome Kern had famously said, when asked of Berlin's place in American music, he said, "Berlin has no place in American music. Berlin is American music." That's 1925, he writes. He says that. In 1928, Berlin writes a theme song for a Sam Goldwyn picture called The Awakening, and it's a song called Marie. It's not a hit. About 15 years later, Tommy Dorsey gets a hold of the song, changes the rhythm a little bit, and of course it becomes a very big
tremendous hit
for
him.
Sort of a signature song for Tommy Dorsey. Mary Pickford's first sound film has an Irving Berlin film theme song. The Coconuts, which was the Marx Brothers' first film, is an Irving Berlin musical.
So what you really see here, and I think for anyone who is of a certain age, it's extremely nostalgic because there are early, early posters and sheet music covers that are displayed here at the Michener.
And production photos.
With production photos and also
caricatures.
Yes, amazing. It's
and
just
things
a fabulous
that you've never
collection.
Seen before. You know, this is a picture of Irving Berlin and Lon Chaney on the movie set with Jack Cohn, or Berlin and Al Jolson playing golf in 1928. Jolson and Berlin were great friends. When Jolson first played the Winter Garden in New York, he was singing an Irving Berlin song. The first period was such a disaster. He came back to New York thinking he was all washed up. Of course, he wasn't. He would go on to write a couple of wonderful songs, had two hit Broadway shows. And once he had these two hit Broadway shows under his belt, he decided to go back to Hollywood. And instead of going to the big studios, which he had done the first time, and work with the biggest stars, he went with a very small studio called RKO. And he realized he not only would he have more creative control, but he also was the first songwriter to get a percentage of the profit, actually the gross. So this period, the second section of the show, covers from 1934 to 1942. He spends almost the entire decade of the 30s working in Hollywood. He writes three Astaire Rogers films. And does three films also for 20th Century Fox. And then comes back and does Holiday Inn for Paramount, which, of course, is a film people are still watching. When he starts working with Fred Astaire, they not only have a great professional relationship, they become great friends. The first film that they work on together is Top Hat, and every song in that score becomes a hit. It's the first time that that all five songs of a musical score are in the top hit parade.
You know, you find yourself eating this exhibit up quickly. I mean, you don't know where to look first. Song titles that jump out at you always, of course, I can't believe that it's 1942, but of course it's as
fresh.
It
was written in 1925, and this is when it was used as the film The Pride of the Yankees,
which
is a Lou Gehrig story.
Teresa Wright, yeah.
Of course, we don't think of Gary Cooper in Irving Berlin, but there it is. on a piece of sheet music together. The RKO pictures he made with a director by the name of Mark Samrich, who was a rabbi's son from New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Oh, my.
And the two of them were very similar. They were both hardworking individuals who would much rather work than go nightclubbing or anything like that. And they kind of understood what the American people wanted. They sort of invented the sex farce without sex, you know, which is really what those Astaire Rogers pictures are. I mean, when they kiss, it's a very big
deal.
Yes,
it's true.
Yet there's a very palpable tension between the two of them in all their films. Also in this period, in 1938, when Berlin's 50 years old, he creates essentially a whole new film genre in which this film, which is not a story of his life, although Zanuck had wanted to make that, it's the first time a songwriter's both old and new songs are used in a score that isn't about his, that isn't about the songwriter's life. And this had 39 songs in it.
Unbelievable. And he changes with the times, actually.
Well, there's a wonderful song from this picture that's not used called Marching Along with Time, which pretty much says that, you know, he just adapts every time something new comes along. He makes a film that nobody remembers, and probably for good reason, called Second Fiddle, which was a picture for Sonja Henie, the great ice skating star.
Right.
The great films of this period are Top Hat, Follow the Fleet, a relatively unknown film called On the Avenue, where Dick Powell and Alice Faye introduce I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm, and then Holiday Inn, which introduces the most popular song of all time, which is White Christmas. Berlin had originally intended the idea to be used as a stage review, and then Mark Samrich heard about it and said this would make a great film. And so he got Fred Astaire and Bing Crosby together. The whole idea was to do songs based on different holidays. We've got a picture here of Bing Crosby in blackface doing the Abraham Lincoln's birthday song called Abraham. And if you think I've seen the film before and I've never seen this number, it's because when it's shown on TV now, they don't show the blackface
number. No, I was going to say there are so many different things that have happened in these past years in terms of what is politically correct, and of course the whole, I guess, the sexual mores and everything that has changed, and it's all reflected in film. And part of walking through this exhibit is really a walk down memory lane, because you really
sure.
You realize where you were at this particular time, if you were around, and how much has changed since that time. And of course the war years, the World War II years,
well,
are very
42
very...
to 45, Berlin does something. He could have done 2 weeks in the USO show and everyone would have felt that he had done his part. He first wrote a number of songs for different parts of the government. Any Bonds Today, of course, is a well-known song that he wrote to sell war bonds. Angels of Mercy, he wrote for the Red Cross. In 1938, he had written God Bless America, where he published God Bless America. He'd actually written it 20 years earlier. And right away, when Kate Smith sang that, he knew it was a special song. Everyone knew it was a special song. And he wanted to give the copyright to the Red Cross and spent 6 months trying to convince them to take the copyright. And finally they said, the Boy Scouts, that's what you want, the Boy Scouts. They thought it was a publicity stunt. And so Berlin gave the copyright to something called the God Bless America Fund, which gives all of its money, there's no overhead, that gives all of its money to the Boy and Girl Scouts of America. It's raised over $10 million over the years. Even when Berlin used the song, he paid for it.
I was going to ask you, here's this song, God Bless America, but Kate Smith really was the one who made it. For some reason or other, her performance of it was so very, very important.
Well, Berlin said that not only was she the first, but she was the best. As I said, when she sang it on November 10th, 1938, Berlin had been wanting to write a song that was sort of "Thank You, America." You know, he was 50 years old. He realized that he couldn't have the career that he had in any other place in America. He could see that war was on the horizon. He had been over in Europe promoting actually Alexander's Ragtime Band, the film of Alexander's Ragtime Band. And he tried a couple of times, and then he remembered this song that he had cut from his World War I show. And he revised a little bit, changed some of the words, changed some of the melody a little bit. He sent a telegram to his friend, Harry Ruby, the songwriter,
yes,
who was his rehearsal pianist for the World War I show, and said, you know, make sure you listen to the radio tomorrow night, because remember that song you liked so much during the war, meaning World War One. I've changed a little bit. I think it's turned out pretty good. She's going to sing it. I'd like to know what you think. The chorus is pretty good. I don't know what I'm going to do with it after this. And, of course, it would become, I think it's close to the national anthem.
And absolutely, very,
I mean, it's a song that everybody can sing, whereas the Star Spangled Banner is very difficult to sing.
That's the way it's written.
And, you know, that is the national anthem. You know, that was only made the national anthem in 1931. And when God Bless America first came out, it was, people liked it so much and found it so easy to sing that there was a movement afoot to make it the new national anthem. And Berlin put an end to it. He didn't think that you could write a national anthem. It had to become a national anthem.
Those are called standards in the business.
And
obviously everyone sings them and everyone plays them, and I think they will forever. How long is the exhibit going to be here at the Michener?
Well, the exhibit is here until September 3rd. And it's a wonderful way to sort of, again, to hear the songs is one thing, to see that the world that they created, and unlike his Broadway work, which you can't see anymore, you can see revivals of, or maybe hear a clip on the radio of, his film work, you get to see exactly what Berlin saw, whether it was in 1930 or whether it was in 1973. These are the exact performances, the exact way they sang, or maybe the way that you saw it 40, 50 years ago. It is a wonderful way, like the paintings you see in the museum. You get to see what Daniel Garber saw in 1926. Coming to this exhibition, you get to see what Irving Berlin saw in 1933 or 1945 or something like that. So it's really worthwhile.
It's wonderful, and bravo to you once again for putting it together.
Thank you.
For the Michener for sponsoring such a wonderful exhibit.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.